It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
the two terms that they keep using, which I take exception with, one is they use the word amnesty. You know, amnesty is, it's a forgiven. That's what I think of when I think of amnesty. But that's not necessarily what the proponents of immigration reform are saying. What we're saying is, first and foremost, everyone has to recognize that these individuals are here in the United States. They're underground. You want to make sure, especially in terms of security, you want to make sure that everyone's accounted for and you know where they are. That's critical. You don't want people underground.
Private attorney Lakshmi Challa at the Challa Law Offices talks about the many ways immigrants can legally live and work in the U.S., and the many complicated procedures involved in the second part of a two-part interview. And during this week's News You Can Use, we talk about a new Social Security policy that hides the name of the judge until the moment of the hearing, and why that's bad for both the claimant and the agency. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show was supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 152, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. In December, the Social Security Administration's Office of Disability Adjudication and Review, or ODAR, announced a new policy that the identity of the Administrative Law Judge, or ALJ, assigned to each claimant's case will not be disclosed until the time of the actual hearing. The rationale for the new policy is to thwart the purported practice of some advocates who farm shop to avoid particular ALJs. But according to the National Organization of Social Security Claimants Representatives, or NOSCRA, the new policy will impair their ability to meet the needs of individual ALJs. Not only do different judges benefit from different preparations by representatives, but some need more time than others, some need claimants to be prepared in different ways, some need written argument in advance, and some need specific presentations at the hearing. NOSCRA expects impaired efficiency at hearing offices as a result of this new policy and protested the new policy in a December 21, 2011 letter to Social Security, noting that concealing the identity of the judge until the moment of the hearing is almost unheard of in a judicial system in a democracy. For more information, go to www.nosscr.org. In other news, a post-adoption contract and communication agreement, or PACA, is a voluntary, legally enforceable written agreement between birth parents and adoptive parents for contact and communication after the legal adoption of a child. The PACA is intended to support open adoptions in Virginia, especially for older children in foster care who have significant emotional attachments to their birth parents. Open adoption is a permanency practice that facilitates communication between birth parents and adoptive parents throughout the lifetime of the child. Unfortunately, this is hardly ever being used in Virginia. This may change as the Virginia Department of Social Services recently issued a new foster care policy manual, including guidance on using a PACA. The department's fact sheet notes that the birth parents and adoptive parents should develop the terms and conditions and, after agreeing, must give the agreement to the child's guardian ad litem, the sponsoring agency or agency completing the adoption report, and the circuit court for approval. Once placed in the final order of adoption, it is legally enforceable. However, the adoption cannot be revoked, even if the adoptive parents do not honor the PACA. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Barton versus Barton. George and Lovenia Barton were married in July 1994 and separated in April 1996. They had no children. The circuit court heard evidence about spousal support on August 6, 1997, and entered a final decree of divorce on October 16, 1997, ordering the husband to pay $450 per month in spousal support. A month later, he petitioned to reduce his spousal support because of a consent order entered on September 23, 1997, requiring him to pay child support for a child born out of wedlock a year earlier. The Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals denied the reduction because there was no material change in circumstances that occurred after the entry of the spousal support order. Mr. Barton knew about the child support order before the spousal support order was entered. Mr. Barton could not withhold known, relevant information and then claim that the withheld information established a change of circumstances. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Barton versus Barton is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
There are many ways immigrants can legally live and work in the U.S., and there are many complicated procedures involved. Last week, we spoke with private attorney Lakshmi Chawla at the Chawla Law Office about how people can come to the U.S. temporarily, whether for school, business, or pleasure, and go back to their home countries. This week, we continue the conversation and talk about people trying to immigrate to the U.S. Here's the second part of a two-part interview with private attorney Lakshmi Chawla about immigration. Okay, so up to now, we've been talking about people coming into the country temporarily and going back to their home countries. Now let's shift the focus to people who are trying to immigrate to the country. What are the common ways that people can immigrate to the country?
Well, I always tell people there are many paths to Rome. There are family-based processes, you know, a manner in which people can immigrate to the United States. There's employment-based. There's also diversity visa and asylum. But for those people who are not in the U.S. already as a non-immigrant, I would say the most common way to enter the United States as an immigrant would be family-based. So you have, even within that, and most people don't know this, there are various categories. So if you are a U.S. citizen and you're filing for your spouse or children, you know, under the age of 21, then even though there is no quota, there is no limitation, the process can be fairly cumbersome. So a U.S. citizen gets married and returns to the United States and they want to bring their spouse, their, you know, newly married spouse into the U.S., it can take up to, you know, 15 months to have them enter the United States.
I assume that there are all sorts of rules to protect the country against people being brought in under what is commonly referred to as, quote, sham marriages.
Absolutely. U.S. citizen has to demonstrate that it is a bona fide marriage. And sometimes that can be tricky, especially when you're dealing with, you know, individuals that have had, you know, maybe a non-traditional marriage, like an arranged marriage, where you may not have as much evidence on the front end to show that there is that relationship and so forth. And what you know, immigration has done, you know, many years ago, has limited the permanent resident visa for these, you know, new entrants. So if I'm a U.S. citizen and I filed for my foreign national spouse, the foreign national spouse gets a permanent resident card, but it is a conditional permanent resident card for 2 years. And after 2 years, the couple needs to go back to immigration, file a waiver to remove the conditions on the permanent resident, and demonstrate that it was a valid marriage and it continues to be a valid marriage.
And after that two-year period, is the immigrant spouse considered to be legally in the country a permanent resident?
Yes, it's no longer. The conditions are removed, so they're a permanent resident and are eligible to file for citizenship.
And what about other ways to enter the United States as an immigrant, a refugee or asylum seeker, those types of things? I assume there are a lot of special rules and procedures for that.
There are. And, you know, the biggest problem that I see with at least those that are seeking asylum, a lot of times you'll have refugees enter the United States. Refugees, typically the term before they, you know, before they enter the U.S. Once they enter the U.S., and they file for asylum, they become asylees. And for those individuals, the biggest, I have found the biggest issue is being able to demonstrate that, you know, it's not just that there is a group of people that are being targeted or they're specifically being targeted, but they have to be targeted because of their religious, you know, some sort of religious issues that are taking place. They're persecuted because of their, you know, religious beliefs in that country, or they're persecuted because they may look a little different. Like, for example, in some African countries, you can distinguish between one group to another by their physical characteristics because they happen to be a part of a regime, and perhaps that regime is being targeted. So a lot of times the individuals think, okay, I did something, my family did something, so I'm being targeted. Specifically, it has to be a little more broader than that.
And what about gender-based asylum seekers? Are there, in fact, situations where someone can seek to immigrate to the country because of their gender?
They can, but being able to prove that is the issue, you know, in terms of their persecution is probably a little more difficult, depending upon the country and the situation. You know, years ago when China had instituted the two-family quota, a number of people immigrated to the United States on asylum, you know, based on the fact that they've had the third child and they were hiding the third child and the repercussions of the country. So it takes very different forms, but the critical issue is, you know, looking to see about, you know, how the persecution is with relation to where they are geographically. And usually experts are called in to, you know, attest to country conditions, their reports from the Department of State, a number of things that are submitted for these applications.
Now, we always hear about the green card, which allows someone to be a legal permanent resident. What is the process that someone has to go through in order to get that green card?
Permanent residence, it's called immigrant classification. Green card is the term that most people use. That card has gone through a number of different colors over the years, so I think it's back to being green. But when you're a permanent resident of the United States, that means you can permanently reside in the U.S. You cannot vote in the U.S. You cannot hold office in the U.S. I would say most political offices. But you are permitted to reside here permanently. And once you've met certain criteria, you clearly can apply for citizenship in the United States. People become permanent residents through sponsorship through their employer. People become permanent residents through sponsorship through family members. So there are many ways in which one can become a permanent resident.
And is that a lengthy process, or is it something that is fairly streamlined?
It can be a very lengthy process. On employment-based, it can, like I had said earlier, it can take up to, you know, 8 years to become a permanent resident in the United States. If you are a permanent resident and you've become married and you want to sponsor your permanent resident spouse who is overseas, that can take up to 4 years. For a U.S. citizen, when they sponsor, you know, that is about 15 months. So as you can see, the time frame varies depending upon who's sponsoring them, and what the relationship is. If a U.S. citizen is sponsoring their brother and sister, that period, the waiting period is about 12 years.
But I gather the key to the whole thing is to have a U.S. sponsor. In other words, if you're in this country or you want to come to this country and become a permanent resident, you can't just do it on your own. You need to have somebody who is already a citizen sponsoring you?
Correct. There is an exception to that. There are certain individuals in the United States, and we do a lot of that work because we're special counsel to the Attorney General of Virginia, and so we represent a number of the universities and colleges, which are very ripe for self-petitions. The U.S. is deemed, as you can see with employment-based, remember how I talked about you have to jump over the Department of Labor hurdle before you can obtain your immigration benefit. The exception to that is if you are a person who has expertise in a very narrow area that could be deemed beneficial to the United States, they have waived the Department of Labor requirement for those individuals. There are more stringent requirements with the Immigration Service that requires the individual to demonstrate that they've risen to the level of expertise in their area, and in some instances that expertise could be beneficial to the United States. So those individuals can self-petition. But for everybody else, for the most part, you need a U.S. sponsorship. Of course, asylees, you know, that's also to a certain degree a self-petition. And then finally, those individuals that come under the lottery. You know, we have this lottery system. And so when people are picked for the lottery, they get a number. And the countries that are allowed to participate in the immigrant visa lottery are those countries where they're not highly represented in the United States. And so even when you get merely getting a lottery number doesn't necessarily guarantee your admission as a permanent resident, but it gives you a chance to perhaps, you know, become eligible. So those individuals also can self-petition.
And could you give our listeners just an idea of what are your odds of being chosen for the lottery if you put your name in?
You know, even if you get chosen, the problem is there's a number and there's also a quota. So they start every month, they'll post numbers on the Department of State Visa Bulletin as to what is being processed for that month. So there are a number of individuals that have received permanent residence through that process. It is not something I'd hang my hat on. You may have a better chance than winning the Powerball, but I wouldn't necessarily count on that to become a permanent resident of the U.S.
And would you describe for our listeners, what is the path to citizenship? How does one become a United States citizen?
First and foremost, you have to demonstrate you were a permanent resident for a certain number of years. Typically, for most people, it's 5 years. You would have had to be a permanent resident for 5 years. The exception to that is if you're married, if you've obtained your permanent residence through marriage to a U.S. citizen, then those individuals only have to show that they've been permanent residents for 3 years. Second, you cannot reside outside the United States for more than 6 months of that statutory period, because if you stay outside the U.S. for greater than 6 months, then you have to start all over again. That would be a breach in your continuous stay. So if a permanent resident goes outside the United States, they have to come back within 6 months if they're trying to meet that criteria. The other prong is, of the 5 years, they would have had to physically reside in the United States at least for 50% of that time.
All right, so they've met that requirement. Then what is the process they go through in order to finally, you know, be able to renounce their citizenship elsewhere and become a citizen of the United States of America?
Well, first I want to say they don't necessarily have to renounce their citizenship. The U.S. is silent on whether they will accept dual citizenship. So clearly it depends on the other country. So, for example, Canada allows for dual citizenship, so one can hold a Canadian passport and a U.S. passport, and it's okay. Belgium does not allow for dual citizenship, so one cannot be a citizen of Belgium and be a citizen of the United States. Just to make this clear, in this process, I'm talking about naturalized citizens. People can become U.S. citizens because they're born in the U.S. People can become U.S. citizens because they have derivative citizenship. So even if they're born outside the U.S., they have one citizenship parent and maybe one permanent resident parent. So there are many ways one can become, you know, a citizen. But for those that are permanent residents and they want to become U.S. citizens, they have to go through this naturalization process where after they've met the requirements that I talked about earlier, they file an N-400 with USCIS. They have to get fingerprinted. There is a test that they need to take on history, politics, and government. And at the end, there is a written kind of English language test that they need to meet. And then an interview takes place. And then they're sworn in as U.S. citizens.
And you've mentioned that this naturalization process can take up to 8 years. Why so long?
Well, it can take up to 8 years because the permanent residence process takes so long, and then you have to meet the statutory requirement for residing in the U.S. as a permanent resident, which is 5 years. So that's why the path is much longer than most people realize.
And I guess as a final question, obviously immigration reform is a major topic in Congress. Little to nothing actually is getting done on this, and there's always this talk about, well, if we grant amnesty, it's going to cause all sorts of problems. There's going to be rush to citizenship. What's your take on that?
Well, first of all, they keep calling it, the two terms that they keep using, which I take exception with, one is they use the word amnesty. You know, amnesty is, it's a forgiven. That's what I think of when I think of amnesty. But that's not necessarily what the proponents of immigration reform are saying. What we're saying is, first and foremost, everyone has to recognize that these individuals are here in the United States. They're underground. You want to make sure, especially in terms of security, you want to make sure that everyone's accounted for and you know where they are. That's critical. You don't want people underground. Number two, the other myth is a lot of these people aren't paying taxes and they're a burden on our system. Well, first of all, a majority of them are paying, you know, they do get, you know, Social Security numbers from some means. They use that Social Security card to get work authorization through the I-9 process and so forth. So they've been paying Social Security benefits. They try to pay tax. They're just not getting the recognition and benefit of what that is. But there are a vast majority of them that are doing that. That's another reason why we want to have them permanently reside in the U.S. is so that, you know, you can make sure that all this is accounted for. And as I said, I take an exception to the fact that they say fast track to citizenship, because even for those that are legally here in the United States, there's no fast track. You have to meet the requirements to get permanent residence in the U.S. That can take up to 8 years. After you get permanent residence, you have to meet the statutory requirement for citizenship, which is 5 years. So 8 plus 5 on average for an IT professional from China or India. So there is no fast track.
Thank you very much. We have been talking with Lakshmi Chawla at the Chawla Law Office in Glen Allen, Virginia, about immigration to the United States and the path to naturalization as a citizen. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the second part of a two-part interview with private attorney Lakshmi Chawla about immigration. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 40.2, which deals labor and employment. The Employment Polygraph Protection Act prohibits most private employers from using lie detector tests, either for pre-employment screening or during employment. But Virginia law still allows this, except for one major area of questioning. Code of Virginia Section 40.1-51.4:3 states that no employer shall, as a condition of employment, require a prospective employee to answer questions in a lie detector test concerning sexual activities, unless such sexual activity has resulted in a criminal conviction. However, What sexual activity has to do with a person's suitability for a job still is anyone's guess. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral four, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Recently, the jurisdictional limit of the General District Court was increased to $25,000, allowing people to obtain larger money judgments without the complexities of circuit court. Join us next week when private attorney David Douthit at the law firm of Allen & Allen discusses taking a small personal injury case to General District Court. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.